Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 142 for April 27th, 2008. Coming up in a few minutes.
The guy pointed across the room and he said, well, you really need to talk to him. That's Elmer T. Lee. He's the person who invented single barrel bourbon. And I looked over and here he was standing there, a very kind of modest man in a suit and a tie. Although he didn't look entirely comfortable in the suit and the tie, just kind of standing there like a shy guy in the middle of a party.
That's Ron Gibbons, author of the new book, Bourbon at Its Best. It's Derby Week in Kentucky, and the bourbon will be flowing this week in Louisville. We'll hear from Ron about his new book and visit one of the best whiskey bars anywhere, the Old Sealback Bar at the Sealback Hilton in downtown Louisville. First, though, let's look at the news. Last week's World Whiskies Conference generated a few headlines, and as usual, many of them focused on Indian billionaire Vijay Mallya of United Spirits. Mallya is still squaring off with the Scotch Whiskey Association. During his speech at the conference, Mallya blasted the SWA's ongoing attempts to lower whiskey import taxes in India and called the attempts heavy-handed and confrontational. On that front, the SWA still has not accepted Mallya's application for membership after his purchase of White & Mackay last year. The association requires whiskey producers to reapply after an ownership change, and India's MoneyControl.com reports that the SWA has told Mallya that United Spirits will not be able to join until it conforms to the Scottish definition of whiskey. In India, United brands its sugarcane molasses-based spirit as whiskey, while the Scottish and European definition of whiskey is limited to grain-based spirits. Mallya also told conference attendees that Scotch whiskey producers need to be more innovative to attract younger consumers, and he's suggesting experimenting with flavors and additives. Needless to say, most of those in attendance did not share Mallya's view, but Drinks International reports some could see the possibility of using whiskey-based cocktails with natural flavorings to make whiskey more popular among young adults. Of course, Mallya's concept would violate every law governing whiskey production in Scotland. There's a new cocktail out that might attract younger whiskey drinkers, if only they could afford it. I've mentioned the 55-year-old Macallan single malt before. It comes in a Lalique crystal decanter and costs about $12,000 a bottle. Now, Chip Griffin of Cork & Knife reports one of the bars at the Burj Al Arab Hotel in Dubai is putting this rare spirit into a cocktail. Hold on now. It's mixed with dried fruit bitters and passion fruit sugar, then served over ice. But not just any ice now. It's made with water from the Macallan's own water source. And to stir it, the bartender uses a stirrer made of wood from a Macallan cask stave. It's served in an 18-karat gold goblet and goes for about $7,500 a drink. You do get to keep the glass. Wow. Finally, Ardbeg is releasing a new single malt exclusively to members of the Ardbeg Committee. It's called Corey Vrecken. It's a cask-strength Ardbeg bottled at 57.1% ABV, and the name comes from the legendary whirlpool near the coasts of Islay and Jura. Back in 1947, Eric Blair and his cousins almost drowned when their small boat was caught in the whirlpool. You know Blair better by his pen name, George Orwell. Ardbeg Corey Vrecken is available through the Ardbeg website. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. It's Spirit of Speyside Festival Week in Dufftown, and there'll be events at many of the Speyside distilleries this week. The New York Academy of Sciences will present a seminar on the science of Scotch May 6th. May 9th, the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's U.S. chapter will hold a tasting dinner in New York City, and I'll be in Toronto May 10th for the Spirit of Toronto Festival. Hope to see you there. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask. Become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay at Laphroaig.com. It's Kentucky Derby Week in Louisville. The bourbon and the mint juleps will be flowing all week long. And one of the busiest bars in town will be the old Sealback Bar. It's inside the Sealback Hilton Hotel. But it's not just any hotel bar. The Sealback is one of those grand old southern hotels. And there's only one word to describe the bar. Amazing. Jerry Slater runs the place.
The hotel itself is 1905. And so there's, you know, a great tradition of horse racing. The hotel opened up Derby weekend in 1905 in May. And, you know, being the proximity to whiskey here, you know, we're halfway between the distilleries in the northeast and the distilleries in the southeast. And, you know, we're almost kind of the gateway in some ways to bourbon country. So a lot of people like to come here and head either up north to, was it Buffalo Trace or Woodford Reserve, or they can head south to Maker's Mark, Heaven Hill, Bardstown area, you know, Claremont to Jim Beam. I mean, you know, so we're kind of, we're positioned to be, you know, a great place to stay for whiskey. So,
and this place has always been, I'm assuming, since the end of Prohibition, really sort of a serious whiskey bar.
I would say before, during, and after. you know, Prohibition wasn't very popular in this part of the country, and if you go upstairs, for instance, to the Oak Room restaurant, the Oak Room restaurant was not always a restaurant. It was actually a gentleman's billiards club, and started back in 1917. There's actually a card table room in there, reportedly, that Al Capone used to visit for bootlegging back up to the north to play cards and what have you. Well, there was actual secret exits to get out of there, spiral staircases to escape to the basement, you know. So there's a kind of a fun history of whiskey in this hotel as well.
Now, to talk about the selection, you have in your, looking at my count, probably, what, close to 60 different bourbons?
About 60, you know, of the, I think last count I saw it was about 135, but, you know, what we have is about 60 of the premium, the top tier of bourbons in the country.
Including some stuff that's bottled just for the hotel, right?
Right. We have, we've worked with Kentucky Distillers to do a Sealback Select. It's a 14-year-old bourbon, uncut, unfiltered, and also Rathskeller Rye. Now, we have a great room in the basement of the hotel here called the Rathskeller. That was, the brothers were German, the Sealback brothers, and they had a great, very gothic beer garden type room in the basement. And so we have a rye whiskey that's 24 years old, actually, and uncut, unfiltered. It's around 132 proof. So,
and then other whiskeys that you have here are some that would be very difficult to find at almost any bar in the country.
You know, yeah, the Van Winkles, we're big fans of those guys. We have quite a few of their selections here. We have some things. I'm looking back there seeing the Sonoma Cutrer finished Woodford Reserve. We just got the Willett family in. You know, big fan of Jimmy Russell from Wild Turkey. So whenever he, you know, his new selection comes out, we'll definitely get that.
And then the right side of the bar is completely full of probably another 60 to 70 different scotches.
Scotch whiskeys. So, you know, this whole, you know, Gary Regan called this the best piece of mahogany this side of the Mississippi. You know, and almost the length of this, as you can tell, is all whiskey. So, yeah.
What went into picking the whiskeys that you choose for the bar? How do you go about selecting new ones?
You know, a lot of people at this point come to us, and when we finally, you know, do decide on things, I mean, a little of it has to do with history. It's not just about what's flashy and new. So, you know, we have Old Granddad 114 back there, for instance, you know. But then we also, like I said, I think the Willett family select was like the last thing we've acquired. You know, so it's about what tastes good, you know, what the palate of people like Edward and Cindy behind the bar, and, you know, the chefs even get into the mix sometimes. They were the ones that helped pick out the Sealback selections.
So, what's the future hold for this bar?
You know, it's been a long run, so I think the future is, you know, keep not listening to suggestions. You know, sometimes keep doing what we're doing. You know, sometimes people want to bring in new products, tequilas or rums and stuff, and that's fine because, you know, ever expanding selection is great. But at the end of the day, I really think we're about whiskey here, specifically bourbon, and like you've mentioned, the Scotch. I mean, that's where we're really, I think, our bread and butter. We do a little jazz on the weekends, you know, that combination of two American originals, you know, jazz music and bourbon whiskey. I don't think that you can beat that.
In fact, there's a cocktail named after the Sealback. It's featured in the new book, Bourbon at Its Best. Author Ron Givens wrote about spirits for the New York Daily News for more than 10 years and distilled everything he's learned about America's native spirit into the book.
I'd say about 15 years ago, I was working as an entertainment journalist at a newspaper in New York City, the New York Daily News. And I started getting interested at that point in better beer. It's a point where the craft beer movement was really taking off for the first time. It's had a few bumps since then, but I just stumbled upon some really great beer. And that started me getting interested in alcohol of a different sort. Beverages that provided a lot more flavor, a lot of variety in flavor, and I began my sort of exploration of better booze with craft beer, and gradually it sort of evolved into being interested in all kinds of stuff, especially in the world of liquor whiskeys. Single malt scotches and all kinds of bourbon were two particular favorites of mine, and as time went on, I just kept, you know, dabbling here and there. And I was able to write about it for the New York Daily News for close to 10 years straight through. And it just kept getting, you know, more and more interested. And I was able to visit places where whiskey was made in Scotland and in Kentucky. And it just became something that fascinated me over and over again. And I guess part of the appeal to me is that my father, when I was a little boy, was a farmer in southwestern Iowa, outside a little town called Hamburg, Iowa. And I was always fascinated at the connections between crops being grown and what happened to those crops. And sort of early on in the history of agriculture in Scotland and in the United States, farmers could take their grains and feed them to their animals, and they could take their grains and turn them into food for themselves and other people. But at a certain point, it became an economic advantage to be able to turn those grains into alcohol, rather than having to transport a huge amount of surplus grain through, you know, horses and wagons and huge volumes. They could take whatever the grain would be, corn or barley or wheat, and transform that into whiskeys in much smaller volumes, things that would be much more easily transportable. And you can find those sort of connections between agriculture and the world of spirits everywhere. Potatoes or rye grains being turned into vodka in Poland and in Russia. And so I guess it kind of tapped into my memories of being a little boy when my dad was a farmer. And I became more interested in where these things came from. Like, how did bourbon come into existence? Why is it only in Kentucky? And so I had, you know, things to ponder as I was enjoying these amazing spirits, you know. And as time went on, I was able to visit some of these places and talk to some of the people who made the whiskeys. And I had an opportunity to do a guidebook. And so it enabled me to kind of gather together a whole range of things, the history of the stuff, how it gets made, where it gets made, what it's like to visit these places, what do these things taste like, what are the aromas that are produced. So it was a really kind of neat way for me to take all of these experiences and put them together in book form, and actually to go beyond my experiences. I had had conversations with people like Jimmy Russell, who the master distiller at Wild Turkey, David Pickerel, who recently left, but all the time I was working on the book, he was the master distiller at Maker's Mark, Parker Beam at Heaven Hill. These were really interesting guys, and in fact, they reminded me of some of the, not all of them, but some of them reminded me of the people that were my father's friends when he was a farmer. The first time I ever saw Elmer T. Lee, who is the master distiller emeritus at Buffalo Trace, and before that, when the distillery was called Ancient Age, he just after World War II, he began working there as an engineer. And in fact, this book would not be possible without Elmer T. Lee, because he's the person who in 1984 decided that there should be a single barrel bourbon, which was kind of a throwback to probably a time before there were fancy marketing campaigns. And he named it after the person who preceded him as a master distiller at that facility in Frankfurt, Albert Blanton. So Blanton's was, you know, the sort of thing that kicked off the sort of better bourbon boom. And the first time I saw him, which was at Whiskey Fest in the early 90s, he looked just like one of the guys my dad used to hang out with. It was kind of stunning, because I was standing talking to somebody from another bourbon distillery, and the guy pointed across the room and he said, "Well, you really need to talk to him. That's Elmer T. Lee. He's the person who invented single barrel bourbons." And I looked over and here he was standing there, a very kind of modest man in a suit and a tie, although he didn't look entirely comfortable in the suit and the tie, just kind of standing there like a shy guy in the middle of a party. And he had a sort of deep tan. I'm from Iowa, so I'm familiar with the term farmer's tan.
Yeah.
Farmers, over the course of the growing season, develop these deep amber tans. You know, I'm going to stretch the point a little bit, because their skin almost begins to resemble the color of a really well-aged bourbon. It's like a deep amber. And I was looking at a guy with a deep amber tan who could have been, you know, a friend of my dad's. So there was that kind of personal fascination when I saw this guy. And I got a chance. Getting a chance to talk to him was one of the highlights for me of working on the book, because I just felt this sort of personal affinity. And he was all of these guys that I talked to, the master distillers, were all very generous with their time and very patient, because I'm not a chemist. So I don't really know what the names of all the acids and esters that are being produced that come together for the amazing range of flavors and aromas. But these guys were very patient and, in some cases, incredibly articulate and very good at describing how bourbon, you know, sort of emerges from this mixture of grain and water and yeast. And so that's, you know, part of what I tried to do in the book was to educate writing the book was in a sense part of my own education.
Tell me who you profiled for the book, because you talked to some really interesting guys that I've had the chance to talk with as well.
Sure. What I did was I singled out the master distillers who have been working for decades. Fascinating guys. Not the most effusive personalities. Elmer T. Lee was one of them. He started at what was then the Ancient Age Distillery as an engineer. This is his job after he got out of the service when World War II ended. And he started working as an engineer in the plant. And actually, he and Jimmy Russell have a similar kind of background. Jimmy Russell and Elmer T. Lee both started as sort of, I'll say, lower-level employees. They had more specific responsibilities at their distilleries. These are distilleries that had different names when they started. Elmer T. Lee started off at what was called the Ancient Age Distillery. It's now called Buffalo Trace. And Jimmy Russell started off at what was the Rippey Distillery, which is now Wild Turkey Distillery. Both of them started off as sort of regular employees, and over time impressed people who were running the distilleries, and got, I'll say, a kind of tutorial in how the whole process works. Their responsibilities shifted over time. They got more, I'll say, responsibility at their respective distilleries, kept impressing the people who ran the place, and over time just took over and ran those two distilleries. Mr. Lee has now been in semi-retirement, and I forget exactly how long, for quite a while. Jimmy Russell is still the master distiller at Wild Turkey. Both of them just had a real talent for I guess what I would call the sensory aspects of the job. They're very good at monitoring the process, but they're also very good at monitoring how the whiskeys are developing in barrels. And they're able to really identify special barrels and find the right ways to turn those into high-quality products. At Heaven Hill, Parker Bean is a slightly different story because he's part of the legendary family that runs all through the history of bourbon in Kentucky. The Bean family obviously is very well known for Jim Bean. And there were descendants of Jacob Bean, who is sort of like a grand old man of the family who moved to Kentucky and started working in distilling. And his grandson is the guy whose name is on the label. That's Jim Bean. And his grandson is somebody who I start the book off with, Booker No, who's a legendary master distiller at Bean. You go to different branches of the family, and you find people who have been master distillers at a whole range of distilleries, nearly all of which have gone out of business, except for Heaven Hill. And Parker Bean is the son of somebody who was a master, Earl Bean, who was a master distiller at Heaven Hill for a long time. And Parker is now co-master distiller with his son, Craig. So here's somebody who's sort of to the manor born, the manor being the Heaven Hill Distillery in Bardstown.
The thing I liked about the book is that you actually put the entire family tree in there, and it took two full pages across the book to do it.
Paul Packle, who's a tremendous spirits writer, did a book about the Beam operation, I'll call it. You know, Jacob Beam descending through Jim Beam, then to Booker No, and now Fred No, who became the master distiller at Beam last year. And it's great to have at least one branch of the family tree explored, but I would like to have, you know, a broader sense of how this whole family operated. Obviously there's some competition. Parker told me, what I asked him was that when you get together for Bean family reunions, whose whiskey do you drink? Which I think is a reasonable question. and he said, well, we all bring our own, which is a politically correct answer. I don't know if they actually do, you know, come with, you know, here's Fred No coming with Basil Hayden, and here's Craig Bean coming with, you know, Elijah Craig or whatever the brands are. But there's also a sense in which these people are family, and they sort of don't have very strong divisions. Baker Bean, who worked as a distiller at the Bean Company, and who has a whiskey named after him in the small batch collection, Baker's, in I don't know if he's done it recently, but not too long ago, as a part-time job, he drove a truck for Heaven Hill. So, you know, these people have a rivalry, and in some cases, I'm sure it's a friendly rivalry. It may get a little heated at times, but it's amazing to think that that this whole bourbon story, which is incredibly intertwined with the story of American sort of development and exploration, is so dominated by one family. It's also intriguing to me, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to do the book.
Ron also includes tasting notes on dozens of bourbons and even gives us some of the details on the few independently bottled bourbons on the market, along with cocktail recipes and details on distillery tours. Again, it's called Bourbon at Its Best. It's available through Amazon.com and the WhiskeyCast store. Finally, I'd like to acknowledge some of the emails I've received recently. Max Sinclair emailed me with details on the Scotch Whiskey Association of Gambier's annual commencement dinner, May 10th. The association is 17 whiskey nuts living on Gambier Island along the coast of British Columbia in Canada, a beautiful place. They're celebrating their third anniversary, and as Mac puts it, they brave the task each month of enjoying every dram they can get their hands on. Of course, that's tough work. Philip Ivan Pietruszka emailed from Victoria, Australia to say how much he enjoys listening to WhiskeyCast. Thanks, Philip. And David Jones emailed with questions on comparing whiskey flavors to beer flavors. He wanted to know how to find out the mash bills for various whiskeys, too. Well, David, for Scotch whiskeys, it's 100% malted barley. And for bourbons, the mash bill has to be at least 51% corn, either wheat or rye, very rarely both, and a bit of malted barley to start the fermentation process. From there on, the actual percentages are a closely kept secret at each distillery, handed down from distiller to distiller. Thanks for the emails. If you have questions or suggestions, my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, and you'll find links, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store, and a complete archive of past episodes at the WhiskeyCast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2008, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.